Ralph had pumped the brakes and held the wheel with his elbows locked, letting it work back and forth a little in his hands, but not too much. He could feel the RV trying to yaw. He glanced up into the rear view at Kirsten, who had stopped playing with Melissa's sweetheart and was now holding the doll against her chest. "Kirsten, sit down," he called. "Belt in." Except by then, it was over. He wrestled the wayfarer off the road, killed the engine, and wiped sweat from his forehead with the back of his hand. "Good driving, Dad," David said in a matter-of-fact voice. Ellie was sitting up now, looking around blearily. "Bathroom break?" she asked. "Why are we tilted this way, Ralph?"
"We had a..."
He broke off, looking into the outside mirror. A police car was rushing toward them from behind, blue lights flashing. It came to a screaming stop about 100 yards back, and the biggest cop Ralph had ever seen in his life almost bounded out. The cop stared right and left, his gun held up to shoulder height with the muzzle pointing at the cloudless morning sky. Then he looked directly into the outside rear view, seeming to meet Ralph's eyes. The cop raised both hands over his head, brought them down violently, then raised and brought them down again. The pantomime was impossible to misinterpret. "Stay inside. Stay where you are." "Ellie, lock the back doors." Ralph banged down the button beside him as he spoke. David, who was watching him, did the same thing on his side of the car without having to be asked. "What?" She looked at him uncertainly. "What's going on?"
"I don't know, but there's a cop back there and he looks excited."
The cop bent and picked something up off the surface of the road. It was a meshy strip with little twinkles of light bouncing off it. He carried it back to his car, dragging one end along the shoulder, his gun still in his other hand, still held up at a kind of port arms. Ellie locked the aft door and the main cabin door, then came forward again. "What in the Sam Hill is going on?"
"I told you, I don't know, but that doesn't look, you know, real encouraging."
He pointed into the mirror outside the driver's window. Ellie bent, planting her hands just above her knees and watching with Ralph as the cop dumped the meshy thing into the passenger seat, then backed around to the driver's side with his gun now held up in both hands. The cop got into his cruiser and drove up the road to the wayfarer. He got out again, his gun still out, but now held along his leg with the muzzle pointed at the road. He looked right and left again, then walked over to Ralph's window. Ralph rolled his window halfway down.
"What's the trouble, officer?"
"How many are you?"
the cop asked.
"What's wrong?"
"Sir, how many are you?"
"4, Ralph said, beginning to feel really frightened now.
"My wife, my 2 kids, me. We have a couple of flats."
"No, sir, all your tires are flat. You ran over a piece of highway carpet."
"I don't..."
"It's a strip of mesh embedded with hundreds of short nails," the cop said.
"What was a thing like that doing in the road?" Ellie asked indignantly.
The cop said, "I'm going to open the rear door of my car, the one closest to your RV. I want you to exit your vehicle and get into the back of mine, and quickly."
He craned his neck, saw Kirsten. She was now holding on to her mother's leg and peering cautiously around it, and gave her a smile.
"Hey, girlio."
Kirsty smiled back at him.
"Who's out there, sir?" David asked.
"A bad guy," the cop said. "A very bad guy. Talk. Further discussion of the situation must wait until our position has been improved. Do you understand?"
"Talk?" Ralph wondered. Was that the bad guy's name?
"Yes, but..." "You first, sir. Carry your little girl. The boy next. Your wife last. You'll have to cram, but you can all fit into the car."
Ralph nodded, rolled up his window, then picked up Kirsten. She looked at him with troubled eyes that were not far from tears.
"Daddy, is it Mr. Big Boogeyman?"
she asked.
"No, not Mr. Big Boogeyman," Ralph said. "Probably just a postal worker having a bad day."
"Daddy, you work for the post office,"
she said, as he carried her back toward the door in the middle of the wayfarer's cabin.
"Yep," he said. "It's a sort of joke, see?"
He looked out the window in the RV's cabin door and saw the cop had opened the back door of the police cruiser. He also saw that when he opened the wayfarer's door, it would overlap the car door, making a protective wall. That was good. He opened the door, and it banged against the inside of the cruiser door.
"Quick, come on, let's see some hustle," the cop said, looking nervously around.
Ralph went down the steps with Kirsty sitting in the crook of his left arm. As he stepped down, she dropped her doll.
"Melissa,"
she cried.
I dropped Melissa's sweetheart. Get her, Daddy.
No, get in the car. Get in the car, the cop shouted. I'll get the doll.
Ralph slid in, putting his hand on the top of Kirstie's head and helping her duck. David followed him, then Ellie. The moment Ellie had pulled her right leg in, the cop slammed the door shut and went racing around the back of the cruiser.
Lissa!
Kirstie cried in tones of real agony.
He forgot Lissa!
Ellie reached for the door handle, meaning to lean out and get Melissa's sweetheart, then looked back at Ralph.
Where's the handles? She asked.
The driver's side door of the cruiser opened and the cop dropped into it like a bomb. The seat crunched back against Ralph's knees and he winced, glad that Kirstie's legs were hanging down between his. Not that Kirstie was still. She wriggled and twisted on his lap, hands held out to her mother.
My doll! Mommy, my doll! Melissa!
Officer, Ellie began. No time, the cop said. Can't. Talk!
He U-turned across the road and headed east in a spew of dust.
Melissa, sweetheart!
Kirstie screamed and then began to weep. The cop slowed briefly as they passed a sign which read, Desperation, then accelerated as he turned right. The car seemed to lift slightly, then settled back. They were now heading south.
What is he, then? Ellie asked. What is this guy?
Up ahead was a huddle of business buildings.
He's a cop. And I'll tell you one thing. When you got a nutty cop on your hands, you got a situation.
Look, Mummy,
Kirsten said brightly. Melissa's sweetheart at least temporarily forgotten.
Bikes! Bikes in the street, standing on their heads. See down there? Isn't that funny?
Yes, honey, I see them, Ellie said. She didn't sound as if she found the upside-down bikes in the street anywhere near as hilarious as her daughter did.
How many cops do you have in a little place like this, officer?
Ralph asked.
Well, there were two others, the cop said, with a smile in his voice. But I killed them.
He turned his head to look back through the mesh, and he wasn't smiling after all. He was grinning. His teeth were so big they looked more like tools than bones.
Now I'm the only law west of the Pecos.
Ralph stared at him, mouth gaping. The cop grinned back, driving with his head turned, pulling up neatly in front of the Desperation Municipal Building without ever looking once at where he was going.
Carvers, he said, speaking solemnly through his grin, welcome to Desperation.
An hour later, the cop ran at the woman in the jeans and the work shirt, his cowboy boots rattling on the hardwood floor, his hands outstretched. But his grin was gone, and Ralph felt savage triumph leap up in his throat. The cop was coming hard, but the woman in the jeans had managed to keep the desk between them, and that was going to make the difference.
Shoot him, lady, Ralph thought. Not to save us, but because he killed my daughter. Blow his motherfucking head off.
The instant before Mary pulled the triggers, the cop fell to his knees on the other side of the desk, his head dropping like the head of a man who has knelt to pray. The double roar of the shotgun was terrific in the closed holding area. The cop's smoky bear hat flew off his head, but the loads went high. Shot hit the back wall of the room and thudded into the plaster stairwell outside the open door with a sound like wind-driven sleet hitting a window pane. The cop's hat was a shredded ruin, held together only by a thin leather hatband. It had been buckshot in the gun, not bird. If it had hit the cop in the midsection, it would have torn him apart. Knowing that made Ralph feel even worse. The big cop put his shoulder against the desk and shoved it across the room toward the cell Ralph had decided was the drunk tank, toward the cell and the woman pressed against the cell's bars. The chair was pinned in the knee hole. The chair back crashed into her hips and pelvis and stomach, driving her backward into the bars. She howled in pain and surprise. The big cop spread his arms like Samson, preparing to pull down the temple, and grasped the sides of the desk.
Drop it, he yelled. Drop the gun, Mary.
The woman shoved the chair away from her, raised the shotgun, and pulled back the double hammers again. Out of the corner of his eye, Ralph saw Ellie put her hands over her ears as the dark-haired woman curled her finger around the triggers, but this time there was only a dry click when the hammers fell. Ralph felt disappointment as bitter as gall crowd his throat. Desk forward a second time, the chair slammed into her midsection again, doubling her forward and drawing a harsh, retching noise from her.
Drop it, Mary! Drop it! The cop yelled.
But she wouldn't. As the cop pulled the desk back again, shells spilling off the top and rolling everywhere, she reversed it so she could grip the twin barrels. Then she leaned forward and brought the stock down over the top of the desk like a club. A cop tried to drop his right shoulder, but the burled walnut stock of the gun caught him on the collarbone just the same. He grunted. The sound drew a scream of approval from across the room, where David was still standing with his hands wrapped around the bars of the cell he was in. The old man with the white hair had joined him. The cop pulled the desk back once more. The blow to his shoulder did not noticeably impair his ability to do this, and slammed it forward again, hitting the woman with the chair and driving her into the bars. She uttered another harsh cry. "Put it down!" the cop yelled. It was a funny kind of yell, and for a moment Ralph found himself hoping that the bastard was hurt after all. Then he realized the cop was laughing. "Put it down, or I'll beat you to a pulp. I really will!" The dark-haired woman, Mary, raised the gun again, but this time with no conviction. She held the gun in the air for a moment, the inlaid stock wavering, then threw it aside. Smiling brilliantly, the cop pulled the desk away from her, went around it, and put an arm around the dark-haired woman's shoulders. "Can you walk?" the cop asked her. "Is anything broken?" "What difference does it make?" she spat at him. "Kill me if you're going to. Get it over with." "Kill you? Kill you?" He looked stunned, the expression of a man who has never killed anything bigger than a wasp in his whole life. "I'm not going to kill you, Mare." He hugged her to him briefly, then looked around at Ralph and Ellie, David and the white-haired man. "Gosh, no," he said. "Not when things are just getting interesting." The man who had once been on the cover of People and Premier when he married the actress with all the emeralds, and the front page of the New York Times when he won the National Book Award for his novel Delight, and in the center spread of Inside View when he had been arrested for beating up his third wife, the one before the actress with the emeralds, had to take a piss. He pulled his motorcycle over to the westbound edge of Highway 50, rolling to a stop on the edge of the tar. Good thing there was so little traffic out here, because you couldn't park your scoot off the road in the Great Basin, even if you had once fucked America's most famous actress, although by then she had admittedly been a little long in the tooth and had been spoken of in connection with the Nobel Prize for Literature. If you tried it, your bike was apt to first heel over on her kickstand and then fall flat on her road bars. And try picking up a 700-pound Harley Davidson once you dumped it, especially when you were 56 and out of shape. Just try. "I don't think so," he thought, looking at the red and cream Harley Softail, listening to the engine tick-tock in the silence. The only other sounds were the hot wind and the minute sound of sand spacking against his leather jacket. $1,200 at Barney's in New York. The literary lion walked stiffly into the desert, his long gray hair brushing against the shoulders of his motorcycle jacket, the scrubby mesquite and paintbrush ticking against his leather chaps, also from Barney's. He looked around carefully but saw nothing coming in either direction. There was something parked off the road a mile or two further west, a truck or maybe a motorhome, but even if there were people in it, he doubted if they could watch the great man take a leak without binoculars. He unzipped his fly. John Edward Merinville, the man Shelby Foote had once called the only living American writer of John Steinbeck's stature, hauled out his original fountain pen. He had to piss like a racehorse, but for almost a minute, nothing happened. He just stood there, with his dry dick in his hand. Then, at last, urine arced out and turned the tough and dusty leaves of the mesquite a darker, shiny green.
"Praise Jesus! Thank you, Lord!" he bellowed in his rolling, trembling Jimmy Swaggart voice. "Water in the desert! Hello, Julia!"
He sometimes thought it was this version of Hallelujah, not his insatiable appetite for booze, drugs, and younger women, that had caused the famous actress to push him into the pool during a drunken press conference at the Bel Air Hotel, and then to take her emeralds elsewhere. That incident hadn't marked the beginning of his decline, but it had marked the point where the decline had become impossible to ignore. He wasn't just having a bad day or a bad year anymore. He was sort of having a bad life. The picture of him climbing out of the pool in his sopping white suit, a big drunk's grin on his face, had appeared in Esquire's Dubious Achievements issue, and after that had commenced his more or less regular appearances in Spy magazine. He spread his legs even wider, bent slightly at the waist and let go of his penis so he could massage his lower back. His prostate clearly wasn't what it used to be. He should have it checked, he knew that. But hey, it wasn't as if he were pissing blood or anything, and besides... Well, all right. He was scared. That was the besides. There was a lot more to what was wrong with him than just the way his literary reputation had gone slipping through his fingers during the last 5 years. And quitting the pills and booze hadn't improved things, as he'd hoped. The trouble with sobriety, Johnny had found, was that you remembered all the things you had to be scared of. He winced as a particularly vicious gust of wind drove a fine sheet of alkali dust against his cheek, his neck, and his hanging organ. This latter had quit doing anything useful at least a full minute ago. Johnny shook it briskly, then slipped it back into his underpants. "Brethren," he told the distant shimmering mountains in his earnest revival preacher's voice, "we are told in the book of Ephesians, chapter 3, verse 9, that it matters not how much you jump and dance. The last two drops go in your pants. So it is written, and so it is." He was turning around, zipping his fly, talking mostly to keep the megrims away, and now he stopped doing everything at once. There was a police cruiser parked behind his motorcycle, its blue flashers turning lazily in the hot desert daylight. It was his first wife who provided Johnny Maranville with what might be his last chance. Oh, not his last chance to publish his work. Shit, no. Once you'd been accepted as a bona fide literary lion, someone would be glad to go on publishing your words, even after they had degenerated into self-parody or outright drivel. No, what Terry gave him wasn't his last chance to publish, but maybe his last to write something really worthwhile, something that would get him noticed again in a positive way. Terry regarded her famous ex with a kind of stoic, amused interest that he found distressing somehow, but she also spoke to him with a straightforward kindness that he found soothing, like a cool hand on a hot brow. They had been in contact more since he'd quit drinking. It was 3 months ago that she'd given him the great idea, tossing it off in a casual conversation that had rambled through what the kids were up to, what she was up to, and of course what he was up to. What he had been up to in the early part of this year was agonizing over the first 200 pages of a historical novel about Jay Gould. He had finally seen it for what it was, warmed over Gore Vidal, and trashed it. "You ought to write some nonfiction. Get away from the whole idea of the novel for a while." "That's dumb, Terry. I can't write nonfiction, and you know it." "I know nothing of the kind," she'd said, speaking in a sharp, don't-be-a-fool tone he got from no one else these days. "During the first 2 years we were married, you must have written at least a dozen essays. Published them, too, for good money. Easy for you to forget. You weren't the one who did the shopping and paid the bills. I loved those puppies." "Oh, the so-called American Heart essays. Right. I didn't forget them, Terry. I blocked them out." "You did 3 or 4 of those essays because someone asked for them. I don't remember who." A miracle, he had thought. She doesn't remember who. "And I'm sure you would have stopped there, except by then you were getting queries from other editors. It didn't surprise me a bit. Those essays were good." He was thinking back, trying to remember if they had been any good. The only one he could remember clearly after all these years was Death on the Second Shift. It had been about a father and son working together in a Pittsburgh steel mill. The father had had a heart attack and died in his son's arms on the third day of Johnny Maranville's 4-day research junket. It had been a wretchedly sentimental piece. The fact that every word was true hadn't changed that in the slightest, but it had also been a tremendously popular piece. The man who edited it for life dropped him a note 6 weeks later and said it had generated the 4th largest volume of letters in the magazine's history. "Do you still have your scoot, Johnny?" "Sure," he said. "It's stored at that garage out in Westport we used to use. You know the one." "Gibby's?" "Yeah, Gibby's. Someone different owns it now, but it used to be Gibby's Garage, yeah." He had been blindsided by a brilliantly textured memory. He and Terry, fully clothed and petting like mad behind Gibby's Garage one afternoon, and, well, a long time ago, leave it at that.
How had they gotten out there in the first place among the cast-off tires and rusty engine parts, standing hip-deep in sunflowers and feeling each other up? He couldn't remember, but he remembered the rich curve of her breast in his hand and how she'd gripped the belt loops of his jeans when he cried out against her neck, hauling him closer so he could come tight and hard against her taut belly. He dropped a hand into his lap and wasn't exactly surprised at what he found there. Say, folks, Frampton comes alive. A new bunch, or maybe even a book. He settled his hand firmly on the back of his chair. Huh? What? Are you going deaf as well as senile? No, I was remembering one time with you behind Gibby's, making out.
Oh, in the sunflowers, right.
Right. There was a long pause when she might have been considering some further comment on that interlude. Instead, she went back to her previous scripture.
I said maybe you could cross the country on your motorcycle and collect material for a new bunch of essays, she was saying. If you front-loaded the best of the early bunch, as part one, you know, you'd have a pretty good-sized book. American Heart, 1966-1996, Essays by John Edward Marinville. She giggled. Who knows, you might even get another good notice from Shelby Foote. That's the one you always liked the best, wasn't it?
She paused for his reply, and when it didn't come, she asked him if he was there, first lightly, then with a little concern.
Yes, he said. I'm here.
He was suddenly glad he was sitting down.
Listen, Terry, I have to go. I got an appointment.
New lady friend?
Podiatrist, he said, thinking Shelby Foote.
Thinking Foote.
Well, take care of yourself, she said. And honest to God, Johnny, think about getting back to AA. I mean, what can it hurt?
Nothing, I suppose, he said, thinking about Shelby Foote. And Terry was right. Of all the praise nuggets he'd ever gotten, that was the one he liked the best.
Right, nothing.
She paused.
Johnny, are you all right? 'Cause you sound like you're hardly there.
Fine. Say hello to the kids for me.
I always do.
They usually respond with what my ma used to call potty words, but I always do.
Bye.
He hung up without looking at the telephone, and when it fell off the edge of the desk and onto the floor, he still didn't look around. John Steinbeck had crossed the country in an old station wagon with his dog. Johnny had a barely used 1340cc Harley-Davidson Softail stored out in Connecticut. Not American Heart, but... Travels with Harley, he murmured. It was a ridiculous title, a laughable title, like a Mad Magazine parody. But he felt the title would work, would rise above its punny origins. A book of essays that might cause the critics to entirely rethink their image of him. A book of essays that might even get him back on the bestseller lists if it was big-hearted, he said. Big-hearted like, well, like Steinbeck. He had scooped the telephone up and called his agent, his fingers flying over the buttons. Bill, he said, it's Johnny. I was just sitting here thinking about some essays I wrote when I was a kid, and I had a fantastic idea. It's going to sound crazy at first, but hear me out. As Johnny made his way up the sandy slope to the highway, he saw that the guy standing behind his Harley and writing down the plate number was the biggest damn chunk of copy he had ever seen. 6'6" at least, and at least 270 pounds on the hoof.
"Afternoon, officer," Johnny said. "Sir, are you aware that parking a vehicle on a state road is against the law?"
the cop asked without looking up.
"No, but I hardly think it can be much of a problem on a road as deserted as U.S. 50, was how he meant to finish, and in a haughty, how dare you question my judgment tone that he'd been using on underlings and service people for years, but then he saw something that changed his mind. There was blood on the right cuff and sleeve of the cop's shirt, quite a lot of it, drying now to a maroon glaze. He had probably finished moving some large piece of roadkill off the highway not very long ago. Likely a deer or an elk hit by a speeding semi. That would explain both the blood and the bad temper.
"Sir," the cop asked sharply, "you were saying?"
"Nothing, officer," Johnny said.
"Now I'm going to let you go."
He looked up for the first time, looked at Johnny, and his eyes widened.
"Go with a warning this time, but..."
He trailed off.
eyes now as wide as a kid's when the circus parade comes thumping down the street in a swirl of clowns and trombones. Johnny knew the look, although he had never expected to see it out here in the Nevada desert and on the face of a gigantic Scandahoovian cop who looked as if his reading tastes might run the gamut from Playboy's party jokes to Guns and Ammo magazine. A fan, he thought. I'm out here in the big nowhere between Eli and Austin, and I found a by-God fan. He couldn't wait to tell Steve Ames about this when they met up in Austin tonight. Hell, he might call him on the cellular later on this afternoon, if the cellulars worked out here, that was.
You're John Edward Marinville, the cop gasped, running it all together as if he really had only one name, like Pele or Cantinflas. You wrote Delight and, oh shit, Song of the Hammer. I'm standing right next to the guy who wrote Song of the Hammer.
Well, yes, I'm Johnny Marinville, he said, speaking in the modest tones he reserved for these occasions. The cop seized Johnny's hand. For just a moment before the cop's fingers closed over his, Johnny saw that the man's hand was also smeared with half-dried blood. Johnny tried to keep his smile in place as they shook. It's getting on me, he thought, and there won't be any place to wash it off before Austin.
Man, the cop was saying, Song of the Hammer's the best book about Vietnam I ever read. Forget Tim O'Brien, Robert Stone.
Well, thank you. Thanks very much. The cop finally loosened his grip, and Johnny retrieved his hand. He wanted to look down at it, see how much blood was on it, but this clearly wasn't the time.
What are you doing out here, Mr. Marinville? I thought you lived in New York.
Well, I do, but I'm gathering material.
For a new novel?
The cop was excited. Johnny looked briefly at the man's chest, hunting for a name tag, but there was none. Well, a new book, anyway. Can I ask you something, officer?
Sure, yeah, but I would be asking you the questions. I got about a gajillion of them. I never thought, out here in the middle of nowhere, and I meet, holy shit.
Johnny grinned. Well, since you're obviously familiar with my work, what would you think of a book of essays about life in contemporary America? A kind of loose travelogue called, he took a deep breath, Travels with Harley. He was prepared for the cop to look puzzled or to guffaw the way people did at the punchline of a joke. The cop didn't either. He simply looked back down at the taillight of Johnny's bike, brow furrowed, considering carefully. Johnny took the opportunity to peek surreptitiously at his own hand, and there was blood on it, all right. Quite a lot. Mostly on the back and smeared across the fingernails. Then the cop looked up and stunned him by saying exactly what Johnny himself had been thinking over the last 2 days of monotonous desert driving.
It could work, he said, but the cover ought to be a photo of you on your drag here. A serious picture. So folks would know you weren't trying to make fun of John Steinbeck, or your own self, for that matter.
That's it, Johnny cried, barely restraining himself from clapping the big cop on the back. The cover should convey seriousness of purpose. What would you think of just the bike, sitting in the middle of some country highway, shadows stretching off to the side? And once again, the cop told him exactly what he wanted to hear.
No, good gosh, no, it's got to be you.
Actually, I think so, too, Johnny said, sitting on the bike, maybe with the kickstand down and my feet up on the pegs. Casual, you know, casual, but real, the cop said. He looked up at Johnny, his gray eyes forbidding, then back down at the bike again.
Travels with Harley. I like it. Of course, I'd read anything you wrote, Mr. Marinville. Novels, essays, poems, hell, your laundry list.
Thanks, Johnny said, touched. I appreciate that. Last year or so has been difficult for me. A lot of doubt, questioning my own identity and my purpose.
Well, I know a little about those things myself, the cop said. You might not think so, a guy like me, but I do. Why, if you knew the day I put in already, Mr. Marinville, could I possibly have your autograph?
Of course, it'd be a pleasure, Johnny said, and took his own pad out of his back pocket.
What's your name, off?
He was interrupted by a long, wavering howl that chilled his blood. not just because it was clearly the sound of a wild animal, but because it was close. The notepad dropped from his hand, and he turned on his heel so quickly that he staggered. Standing just off the south edge of the road, not 50 yards away, was a mangy canine with thin legs and scanty, starved-looking sides. "My God," he murmured. "What's that? Is it a
coyote?" the cop said. "Some people out here call 'em desert wolves."
The cop took a step toward the coyote, then another. He paused, then took a third. The coyote stood its ground, but began to shiver all over. Urine squirted from under its chewed-looking flank.
"Talk," the cop said. "Talk Allah."
The wolf stared at him, as if it understood this Indian-sounding gibberish. The wind gusted again, blowing his dropped notepad over onto the shoulder of the road, where it came to rest against a jutting chunk of rock. "This goes in the book," he thought. "Everything else I've seen is still up for grabs, but this goes in rock solid, rock goddamn solid."
"Talk,"
the cop said again, and clapped his hands together sharply, once. The coyote turned and loped away, running on those scrawny legs with a speed Johnny never would have expected.
"Gosh, aren't they ugly," the cop said. "And just lately they're thicker'n ticks on a blanket."
"What did you say to it?" Johnny asked. "That was amazing. Was it Indian, some Indian dialect?" The big cop laughed.
"That was just baby talk, like oogie woogie snooky wookums."
"But it was listening to you."
"No, it was looking at me," the cop said, and gave Johnny a rather forbidding frown, as if he were daring the other man to contradict him. "I stole its eyes, that's all. I suppose most of that animal tamer stuff is for the birds, but when it comes to slinkers like desert wolves, well, if you steal their eyes, it doesn't matter what you say. They're usually not dangerous unless they're rabid anyway. You just don't want them to smell fear on you. Or blood."
Johnny glanced at the big cop's right sleeve again and wondered if the blood on it was what had drawn the coyote.
"Really," Johnny said, "that's fascinating." "It is, isn't it?" the big cop said and smiled. "Desert lore. Scripture in the wasteland. The resonance of lonely places."
Johnny stared at him, jaw dropping slightly. All at once his friend the policeman sounded like Paul Bowles on a bad karma day.
"Oh, hey, time out," the cop exclaimed. "You'd better stow that, Mr. Marinville."
"Huh?" For one exceedingly strange moment, he had the idea the cop was talking about his thoughts, as if he practiced telepathy as well as elliptical pretentiousness, but the big man had turned back to the motorcycle again and was pointing at the left-hand saddlebag. Johnny saw that one sleeve of his new poncho, bright orange for safety in bad weather, was hanging out of it like a tongue. He had been an intuitive man all his life. It was intuition, not planning, that had been responsible for his best work as a writer. Now, looking at the poncho dangling out of the unbuckled saddlebag, Johnny felt alarm bells start going off in his head. The cop did it. That was completely senseless. But intuition told him it was true just the same.
"Well," the cop asked. He was smiling. "Are you going to take care of it or not? Talk!"
His heart jumped. Talk? What does that mean?
"I didn't say talk, you did. You said talk."
The cop crossed his arms and stood smiling at him.
"I want out of here," Johnny thought.
He moved to his saddlebag, catching a whiff of the cop as he went by. For one moment, Johnny had a brilliant but unfocused memory of his drunken, abusive, crazily funny father, who had always seemed to smell exactly as this cop did now. Old Spice on top, sweat underneath the aftershave, plain old black-eyed meanness under everything. Both of the saddlebag's buckles were undone. Johnny reached for the hanging arm of the poncho, then stopped as he saw what was lying on top of his pile of AAA maps. Part of him was shocked, but most of him wasn't even surprised. He looked at the cop. The cop was looking into the saddlebag.
"Oh, Johnny," he said regretfully. "This is disappointing. This is tray disappointing."
He reached in and picked up the gallon-sized baggie lying on the pile of maps. Johnny didn't have to sniff to know that the stuff inside wasn't cherry blend. Stuck on the front of the baggie, like someone's idea of a joke, was a round yellow smile sticker. That's not mine, Johnny Maranville said. His voice sounded tired and wavery like the message on an old phone answering machine. That's not mine, and you know it's not, don't you? Because you put it there.
Oh, yeah, blame the cops, the big man said. Just like in your pinko liberal books, right? Man, I smell the dope the second you got close to me. You reek of it. Talk!
Look, Johnny began. Get in the car, fag! The gray eyes were full of laughter. That's a joke, Johnny thought. Some kind of crazy, practical joke. Then, from somewhere off to the southwest, more howls rose, a tangle of them this time, and when the cop's eyes rolled in that direction and he grinned, Johnny felt a scream rising in his throat and had to press his lips together to keep it in.
My children of the desert, the cop said. The Kantwa! What music they make!
Johnny stood watching him. Travels with Harley, the cop said. Do you know what a stupid name for a book that is? To plunder the literary legacy of John Steinbeck, a writer whose shoes you aren't fit to lick? That makes me mad! And before Johnny knew what was happening, a huge silver flare of pain went off in his head. He was aware of staggering backward with his hands clapped over his face and hot blood gushing through his fingers, of flailing his arms, and then he was lying on his side in the road, screaming up at the blue socket of the sky. The nose under his fingers no longer felt on straight. It seemed to be lying against his left cheek.
The truth is, it makes me sick with rage, the cop said, and kicked Johnny's ass high up toward the small of his back.
He writhed and crawfished on the broken white line, screaming and bleeding from his broken nose and coughing out sand, while in the distance, coyotes howled at the thickening shadows stretching out from the distant mountains.
Get up, the cop said. On your feet, Lord Jim.
I can't. Jesus Christ, you hurt me so bad.
The gunshot was deafening, the ricochet of the slug off the road a monstrous wasp whine, and Johnny was on his feet even before he was 100% sure he wasn't dead. He stood drunk swaying back and forth.
Hey, big shot, you wet your pants, the cop said.
Johnny looked down and saw he had. No matter how much you jump and dance, he thought.
You're a sorry excuse for a rider. You're a sorry excuse for a man, the cop said.
He shook his head disgustedly. He opened the back door of his cruiser.
Get in, big shot.
Where are you taking me?
Where do you think I'd take a self-indulgent, pinko, pothead asshole like you? To the old Calabozo. Now get in the car.
Johnny got in the car. As he did, he touched the right breast pocket of his motorcycle jacket. The cellular phone was in there.